As Julie said in her introductory remarks, I want to do some thinking with you about courage and fear, and not by way of contrast necessarily to our question that we have when we enter the cathedral over Lent, do not be afraid, but how there might be a difference between that being afraid and fear. What do fear and courage have in common? I want to explore how closely they sit together, how they shape each other, and to suggest that they are essential one to the other. Fear is a primal human response to stimuli, and if it's primal, therefore it is part of us being made in the image and likeness of God. If so, then fear has the potential to be transformative. It has the potential to provide a mean of God's self-disclosure. Further, that fear, without fear, there can be no courage. Courage is dependent upon fear. It's a response to it. Now, being afraid is different. Being afraid is not transformative. It's paralyzing, and it's a detriment to flourishing. Fear is part of the human condition, and therefore it's transformative. A vital response to physical and emotional danger. If we didn't feel it, we couldn't protect ourselves from legitimate threats. Fear causes a physiological change in our brain and other organs, provoking a behavioral response, running away, hiding, or even freezing. And of course, this is known as the fright or flight reaction caused by hormones following the stimulus, whether they're physical or emotional. And this fear response of being able to do fright or flight is what has ensured human survival. The work of many psychologists over decades have described fear as an emotion. More than 50 years ago, Paul Ekman gave the primary tool to his successors. Emotions, he says, are discrete, measurable, physiologically distinct. And he suggested six primary emotions. We have primary colors. He suggested six primary emotions. They are anger, disgust, fear, happiness, sadness, and surprise. And of course, further work has suggested a whole color wheel of emotions based on these primary ones, just like you have a color wheel for paint, choosing it in your house. And these basic emotions of human beings have ensured our survival. They've generated responses which have kept us safe. We flee from, or we prepare to fight with, those things we fear. This is a human reaction. A universal emotion provokes that kind of reaction. So with this, we also say, do not be afraid. What could this be about if fear is so crucial? Courage, I want to suggest, by contrast to the flight or fright, courage is not a reaction. Courage is a response. Reaction happens. We don't know about it. It just does. It's very fast. It's part of our central nervous system. Courage is a response, often measured, and it presents itself in times of testing. Often we don't even know that we showed it until we look back and found it. Wonderful story this morning, I'm sure you all saw it, of the young soldier awarded the Victoria Cross for showing such courage in the face of the enemy, such courage in demonstrating leadership to the others in his unit. Of course, he said he wasn't being courageous at all. He was just doing his work. I bet he felt very, very afraid indeed. Now, unlike fear, believe it or not, courage is a really tricky theological concept. And I think that's because it has two family trees. Many theological concepts are far more complicated than we first think that they are. But courage in particular has got two family trees I want to just trace with you for a bit. One family tree goes all the way back to Plato's Republic and what Plato called the cardinal virtues. Now, 350 years before Christ, Plato, who was a philosopher and mathematician, developed the first systematic theory of what he called forms, but we might call them ideas. He laid the foundation of Western philosophy. And Aristotle, who you will have also heard of, was his student. And he articulated four crucial, cardinal, pivotal virtues: wisdom, justice, temperance, and fortitude or courage. So this is one branch of courage when we think about it. One of its, part of the branches of its family tree goes back to Aristotle, time before Christ. The other branch goes pretty much back to the first century, and of course heavily influenced by the experience of martyrdom in the early church. So courage then, on that part of the family tree, is a mean between recklessness and cowardice on one side, and the capability of the human character to resist pain, danger, or adversity on the other. Courage shows itself by enduring that which cannot be changed. This, in turn, gave birth to an idea of passivity as a feature of true courage, and that's more often called fortitude in the writings. If we read the stories of the saints in the Middle Ages and monastic treatises and manuals and so on, fortitude is described as a reasoned response, not a reaction, a reasoned response to what cannot be changed. Passive submission to the inevitable. You can see how that anchors itself with martyrdom. Later on in the 13th century, the philosopher and priest Thomas Aquinas began his systematic synthesis of the teachings of Aristotle, the one family tree, with that from Christianity, the other family tree, and wove together what he then called were cardinal pivotal virtues, wisdom, justice, temperance, and courage, with theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. And therefore, in that weaving together, constructed an ethical scheme. Part of that has continued to baffle Christian thinkers for that time. We're still in the same place. What exactly is courage? From where does it derive? And what is its purpose? If we think of courage and fear as being two sides of a very thin piece of paper, then perhaps we don't need to ask the question, is one human and the other divine? Are they both gifts from God? Does courage require fear? And is fear there so that we can learn courage? That's not what this lecture is about tonight. But part of the difficulty in locating where courage is, much less defining it, lies in the fact that it in itself is psychosomatic. It's a response. It's so versatile and presents itself in a wide spectrum, from retreat to daring to resistance. We know it takes courage to fight. We also know it takes courage to walk away. This is how the philosophers would say the virtues, courage, and wisdom work together. And in thinking about this fear and courage and still wanting to hold on to that which is from our scriptures, of course, do not be afraid, I chose again these two people, these two lenses through which to look. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, you may well know, he wrote The Cost of Discipleship. We're thinking about our discipleship this Lent. And then I remembered something from the biography of Maya Angelou written by Marcia Gillespie. And I found it. Dr. Angelou is quoted as saying, courage is the most important of the virtues because without courage, you cannot practice any of the others consistently. Courage is the most important of all virtues because without it, you can't practice any other virtue consistently. And that statement, I think, addresses the question, what is courage, and leaves behind a bit of that more complex theological intrigue of the family tree. However we think of its derivation, courage is that without which nothing else is possible. And this is a circle I want to try and draw with you tonight. Fear is part of the human condition, the divinely made human condition. Courage is response to the fear when that fight or flight reaction has come and has gone again. Courage is what we are left with. In addition to Maya Angelou, I'll reflect to you some of the experiences and legacies of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and then, as Julia said, with Jesus and his time in his wilderness. From the third chapter of the book of Proverbs, writing about the fruits of wisdom, we read this. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden fear when it comes, for the Lord will be your confidence. When the fear comes, don't be afraid of it. I think this is more than semantic. When this fear, this intrinsic human emotion is felt, do not be afraid. Because being afraid is crippling. Facing the fear is where we find the courage. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer, German Lutheran pastor and theologian, a key founding member of the Confessing Church in Germany. You probably will know far more about him than do I. But he was born in 1906 and he died in 1945. He was born into a large family, and of that family, one of his brothers was executed with him. Two of his sisters married men were then executed by the Nazis. Two sisters had to escape for their lives and they survived. One of those sisters was imprisoned in the concentration camp but survived. He was an outstanding theologian, and he gained his undergraduate and his master's and two doctorates before ever the age of 25. That really is achievement. He was destined for ordination, but he was too young. So he went to the United States to do some postdoctoral studies, and it was while he was there that he fell under the influence of Reinhold Niebuhr. Some of you may have read his writings, and particularly with regard to how theology hits the road in terms of social justice. And in particular, a fellow seminarian, a black man called Frank Fisher, if there's any other Americans here, you too will have heard about him. And he introduced Dietrich Bonhoeffer to some of the more what we might call liberation theologians in the United States who were talking about a black Christ. What did it really mean to have Christ come to be in our midst? How would that strengthen people struggling against the denial of their own humanity? And so he very much became influenced not just by the call of minorities, but also what he became convinced about was that the church's ineptitude to deal with some of this difference. And he began to see things from another perspective, from the perspective of those who suffer oppression. He said, "One here, one can truly speak and hear about sin and grace and the love of God, because the black Christ is preached with passion and vision." And he describes this experience as the point at which he turned from phraseology to reality. And he gained a great love for and a determination to facilitate ecumenism at a time when the church was at least as divided as we are now. He returned to Germany and became a lecturer. He was appointed by the World Alliance for Promoting International Friendship through the churches. Fortunately, that's what the World Council of Churches used to be called. That's quite a mouthful. And he was one of the three youngest European youth secretary and eventually ordained when he was 25. This career, both his academic and his ecclesiastical career, dramatically altered when the Nazis rose to power in 1933. From the earliest days, he was an opponent of the regime. Months later, he declared the church must not simply bandage the victims under the wheel, but jam the spoke in the wheel itself. The Confessing Church was formed, and it became a major source of Christian opposition to the Nazi government. And working with Karl Barth, they issued an opposing protocol and regime for Christians. And eventually the National Church in Germany passed a change to their foundational documents, inserting a paragraph prohibiting non-Aryans from taking up any parish posts. And so when Bonhoeffer was offered a parish post in eastern Berlin, he refused it and accepted a two-year appointment of a pastor of two German-speaking Protestant churches in London. And one was in Sydenham, where I lived and worked for 26, 27 years. And it's a wonderful tribute to not just only the work that he did, but to the support that he received and what he was doing from English Christians here. But he described his going to England as going into the desert. Now, we wouldn't necessarily think of it like that. I'm an immigrant. I didn't really think of it like that. There's too much rain for it to be a desert. But he thought that in leaving Germany and going to this part where it was a desert, that perhaps his ecumenical work could be strengthened and he could witness to the confessing church and gain some strength for it abroad. Karl Barth really criticized him for leaving, accusing him of running away, of denying his splendid theological armory, of deserting the house of your church while it's on fire. He had to show quite some courage to stand up to Karl Barth and to remain in England for 2 years. But eventually he went back and he began to teach and to train ordinands, and things became more and more difficult. Barth had to leave and go to Switzerland. Other leaders of the church were arrested. And finally, in 1936, Bonhoeffer was denounced as a pacifist and an enemy of the state. 27 of the pastors who he had trained and worked with were arrested. And at that time, in the midst of all of this, he published perhaps his best-known book called The Cost of Discipleship, a study in the Sermon on the Mount. And in the next 2 years, he traveled secretly in Germany and conducted pop-up seminaries. We think it's a new thing, but he conducted pop-up seminaries. He supervised his students, and he helped them because most of them were working illegally. And it was during this time that he made contact with members of the German resistance, the military intelligence who were seeking to overthrow Hitler. This was at great personal cost to him. He knew he was putting himself right in the firing line of anything that was going to happen to anybody who was trying to overthrow Hitler. When he learned the war was imminent, and as a committed pacifist, opposed to the Nazi regime, he was particularly troubled about the possibility that he might be conscripted, and so he left the United States. He didn't escape, he left, he was invited to go and be a lecturer at the United Seminary in New York. But he very soon came to see it was the wrong decision. He wrote to Reinhold Niebuhr and said, "I've come to the conclusion I made a mistake. I must live through this difficult period in our national history with the people of Germany. I have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany if I don't share the trials of this time with my people. Christians in Germany will have to face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose with courage. I cannot make that choice from this security." And he returned to Germany on the last steamer that left New York. He was forbidden from speaking, from working, and he eventually came to the conclusion, the ultimate question for a responsible man is to ask not how he's to extricate himself heroically from this affair, but how the coming generation will possibly continue to live. He had one last-ditch effort. He had become very close colleagues with the Bishop of Chichester, George Bell. And the Bishop of Chichester petitioned Anthony Eden for help for the Confessing Church. And the word is, and of course, history is always written from a different point of view than we're reading. The British government ignored these requests as it had all previous ones from the German resistance. He continued to write. He published another seminal volume called Ethics. He wrote letters to keep up the spirits of his former students. And eventually in 1943, he was arrested. And he was imprisoned, awaiting trial, but he was not downhearted. He continued his work in outreach among his fellow prisoners and his guards. He was able to captivate with the Christian message of courage in the face of such fear many guards that they helped smuggle his letters out of prison. It's these uncensored letters which were posthumously published in Letters and Papers from Prison. One guard was so keen on helping him that he promised to help him escape. But Bonhoeffer didn't want to leave those who were in prison or to bring any danger to his family and colleagues. And then finally, the plot in which Bonhoeffer was involved, the plot to assassinate Hitler, became known, documents were discovered, and Hitler went berserk. Everybody that was involved and named in the papers which were discovered were arrested, and he was moved from the military prison where he was. He had an English prisoner colleague, let's find his name, Payne Best. I think it's such a good name, but it's worth remembering. He was in prison with an Englishman, Payne Best, and as he was being led from that prison, he asked him to remember him to Bishop George of Chichester, saying, "This is the end, but for me, it's the beginning of life." From Tegel Military Prison, he went to Buchenwald and finally to Flossenbürg. And condemned to death, he had a trial. 4 days later, he was hanged. It was just 2 weeks before the camp was liberated, and just 3 weeks before the Russians captured Berlin, a month before the capitulation of Germany. He demonstrated enormous courage, but hardly anywhere does he speak of it. Hardly anywhere does he speak of fear. In his letters, he writes to so many people, including his fiancée of just 3 months, that they be not afraid. When they feel fear, they don't be afraid. That they have courage, they have trust in God, they have trust in all that's being done for lasting health, for the flourishing of their society and community. But what he wasn't absolutely sure about was whether what he was doing was right. And he did show fear about that, about his participation in the plot to kill Hitler. He didn't justify his actions. He accepted he was taking guilt upon himself. And he wrote this: "When a man takes guilt upon himself in responsibility, he imputes that guilt to himself and no one else. He answers for it. Before other people, he may be justified by the necessity. Before himself, he's acquitted by his conscience. But before God, he can only hope for grace." He took a step out really into the unknown for him, relying on the grace which is absolutely the DNA of all of his writings and his letters. But he just didn't know. He had fear, but he was not afraid because he had courage. This is what he wrote about fear, what is actually a sermon, 1933, just before Hitler came to power. "The overcoming of fear, that's what we proclaim. Right in the middle of this fearful world is a place that's meant for all time, which has a task the world doesn't understand. Fear is overcome. Don't be afraid. In the world you're frightened, but be comforted. Don't be afraid. Be of good courage. How can you meet the enemy with fear in your heart?" Now, Maya Angelou, very different setting, different culture, different context. She was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1928 and had one beloved older brother. Her parents' very stormy marriage came to an end, and she and her brother went to live with their paternal grandmother in Arkansas. Now, her grandmother, to great exception of how most African Americans lived at that time, was financially fairly prosperous. She had a general store. She was very careful with her money. They had 4 good years there. And then, without notice, the children's father came and took them back to their mother. And it was at the age of 8, when living with her mother, that Maya Angelou was raped by her mother's boyfriend. She told her brother, which was brave in itself. Her brother told other members of the family. And the man who did it was arrested, and he was tried, and he was put in jail for just 1 day. 4 days after he was released, he was murdered, probably by her uncles. At that point, she became mute for about 5 years. She believed, she said, that her voice killed him. "I thought my voice killed him. I killed that man because I told his name. And then I thought I would never speak again, because my voice will kill anyone." And her biographer paints a picture that it was during this time she came into her love of books, of literature, her ability to listen and to observe carefully all the world around her. Back to the grandmother. And there was, as there so often is, a wonderful, inspiring teacher who introduced her to works by Charles Dickens and Shakespeare, Edgar Allan Poe and other American writers, and to wonderful art from black female artists like Frances Harper and Anne Spence. And that teacher helped her find her voice again. Moved to California, she became the first black woman streetcar conductor before she ever left school. And she graduated from high school just 3 weeks before the birth of her first and only child when she was 17. That took some doing. What also took some doing was she married a white man. Not just was he white, but he was foreign a bit like me. He was Greek in America. Interracial marriage was illegal in so many parts of the United States. She was a real polymath, a nightclub singer, a professional calypso dancer, an actor. She toured Europe with the production of Porgy and Bess. And she decided in every country she went, she would learn its language. After a few years, she gained proficiency in several languages. She composed, sang, recorded her own calypso music, and then eventually moved to New York and concentrated on writing. Before she ever published anything that anybody knew, she was involved in the civil rights movement. She met Martin Luther King and was so inspired by hearing him speak that she organized a cabaret to raise money to support the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was the conference, the group of people with whom Martin Luther King worked most closely. She was indefatigable in her raising money for the civil rights movement and absolutely convinced anti-apartheid activists during this time too. She spent some time living in Africa, writing for African newspapers, broadcasting for Radio Ghana. She became friends with Malcolm X. She helped him build a new civil rights organization. She was devastated when he was assassinated. She was just about to organize a march for Martin Luther King when he was assassinated, very sadly, on her 40th birthday. But she decided the only way to respond to these devastations was to write a television documentary, the first black woman to have done so. And finally, she succumbed to the pressures of a publisher and began to write her first autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Some of you may have heard of it. She eventually wrote 7 autobiographies. She wrote the first screenplay by a black woman. She composed for Roberta Flack. She wrote articles, short stories, TV scripts, poetry, and was named as visiting professor in many universities. Nominated for a Tony, for a Grammy Award. She was in the miniseries Roots, which you may have seen as well. Eventually, though, in spite of all of these achievements, she knew she needed to return to the Southern United States and face her past. And her past was not being able to go to college. Nevertheless, she had a visiting professorship, many honorary doctorates. She called herself a teacher who writes. As well as her autobiographies, it was her poetry that brought her to notice. She recited a poem at the inauguration of President Clinton. She was there at Obama's presidential inauguration. His sister is named for her. She was rewarded by him, the Medal of Congress. Maya Angelou is not known for her fear. The way she writes in her books, she also doesn't really write much about courage, except for the importance of it, as being that without which nothing else is possible. She rarely refers to fear. You may find lots more references. She rarely refers to fear, but when she does, it's something like this. She says, nothing so frightens me as writing, but nothing so satisfies me. It's like a swimmer in the channel. You face the fish and the waves and the cold and the grease, and finally you reach the other shore and put your foot on the ground. Perhaps those of you who are writers know what that's like, about what hard work it is. That's the kinds of things that frightened her. To be the first black woman to do all the things she did as the first black woman, she didn't feel any fear. Looking back, she's not sure she felt courageous. She says, all my work, all my life is about survival, plodding survival. But survival with grace and faith. While one encounters defeat, one must not be defeated. Without fear, she would have never had the courage to overcome those obstacles she faced. And she writes that she was graciously granted courage. The most important of the virtues without which you can't practice any others. Both Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Maya Angelou knew that graciously granted courage, of how closely courage and fear walk together. And none of them really noticed or talked about how courageous they were acting, just like the soldier who won the Victoria Medal. They just are, as they were being courageous, what they mostly felt was the fear. And what about Jesus? We know even less about Jesus than we might know about Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Maya Angelou. Snapshots of his life from Mark, widely believed to have been the first gospel to be written, and widely believed to be from the point of view of Peter, the fisherman. This material was used by Matthew. Matthew added other details that he could remember, that he thought worthwhile to include. And then Luke took material from both of them and from another source, writing from Mary's point of view, and wrote two volumes, the Acts of the Apostles and the Gospel which bears his name. And they each ordered their material in a different way because it was for a different purpose. And in the fourth Gospel, we read something about how they felt, that's modern language, about what Jesus did and said, not just what he did, but how it might have had an effect on them. And this is what we have. We just have some things, stories, and then we have how they affected the people that were there. And so we can step into that story because we too are affected by the stories of Jesus and by our question about, did he have fear? If he was human, perhaps yes. Did he show courage? Well, we can say yes, he did show courage. Was he afraid? Well, let's see. Courage is produced by fear. Courage is a catalyst to action. Jesus faced fear. I think he did. And he found courage. But he was not afraid. Now, gallons of ink has been used in an analysis of what Jesus may have known about himself and when. What did his mother tell him about how he came to be conceived? What she pondered in her heart, as the scriptures tell us, after he was presented in the temple. What happened when she visited Elizabeth when she was carrying Jesus. What on earth did they talk about? I'd love to know what they talked about on the way home from the temple in Jerusalem when Jesus was 12 and he'd gone missing for 3 days. What on earth was that like? Was it just silence as there would be between an adolescent and parents? What did he discover in his private conversations with Mary and Martha and Lazarus? He loved them so much. And we aren't going to solve the riddles, not now and not us anyway. Perhaps these things aren't ours to know. But what is at the bedrock of Christian faith and declaration is that Jesus was fully human. Not part human, not superhuman, but fully human. His fear, joy, love for his friends, his anger at injustice, human responses and reactions. So he too would have needed fear as he was growing up, just like all children do, to learn limits, to learn how to live safely, to live well. So it follows that if Jesus knew fear, he would also have known courage. Would those looking on, would they see that he demonstrated courage? Probably. Was he crippled by fear? There's nothing to suggest that he was, only that he found ways of following that advice from the Proverbs, do not be afraid of sudden fear. So Jesus, in his desert, in his wilderness. The word that the evangelist used to describe that desert or wilderness is not what we might imagine as a desert or wilderness. Necessarily, it's just a desolate place. We know what it's like to feel that we have an internal desert. We feel desolate, alone, abandoned, scared. Now, however Jesus found himself in that desolate place, again, the evangelist can't agree. Was he led? Was he compelled? Was he thrust? Did he have a choice? I think he probably did. He was in that place of desolation. And in a place of desolation, human beings are afraid. At times when Jesus was afraid, he ran away. We know that when he was going to be mobbed, or when he was afraid they were going to make him king, he managed to run away, to disappear from their midst. And we know other times he stood up for himself. Either way, using the virtue of courage, as his fear was prompting that. So then, in this desolate place, it's interesting, and perhaps you'll want to, during this time of Lent, to read the different accounts that there are in the Gospels of what happened in that time. And I think they're such important, tender stories, because if in a desolate place, and alone, the only one who could have communicated anything of what it was like for Jesus was Jesus himself. He had to have relayed this story to his friends. That he was hungry and alone. That either, depending on who wrote the story, that during those 40 days he was tempted, or it was afterwards when he had been without food for 40 days. But he was pressed. He was pressed to be afraid by the tempter. He was pressed to question who he was. If you are the Son of God, what greater fear is that than to lose our identity? If God said this, didn't God say that? You can do this. If you do that, everybody will see God's power. Jesus had what we have, what people have today to rely on, is what we have in our inner being. We have the courage which responds to fear, the courage which is a catalyst to action, which encourages us to draw on those other deep, deep wells that we don't even know are there necessarily until we need them. And so for him, he was able to, in his mind, to remember the scriptures he'd learned at his parents' knees about how to address those questions that sought to make him afraid. If you are the Son of God, if you are really yourself, if you really do have something to do to contribute, what kind of Messiah will you be? I believe that the courage that Jesus showed was because he felt the fear, and he was not crippled by it. He was not afraid of the sudden fear. The Lord was his confidence. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. It doesn't mean you will not feel fear. There's very little in the writings of Maya Angelou that refer to a faith in Jesus. Like many Americans, God and Jesus are one. Like for many Americans, God and Jesus are one. Faith in God is a faith in Jesus. And what God can do, no one can stop. And that's woven through her writings. Her courage is communicated as a way that God's givenness inside herself. For Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the courage that he experienced is one from which he could not walk away. He had to be in that place where his people were, where his calling was, where he would resist evil, even when he was unsure and perhaps fearful that that was the right way to do it. He trusted in that gracious gift of grace. And for Jesus, too, he needed to learn to trust in the gifts of God. He was not superhuman, he was fully human. And how Jesus addressed those questions of himself are something which also can help us when we find ourselves tempted to be afraid. When we need to hear that story again, do not be afraid. The fear will not have the final word, because wherever the fear is, the courage is. That's our circle. Without fear, there could be no courage. Fear is a human, it's a divinely inspired, human, innate, primary emotion which we will all feel. How then does that courage address the question we've set ourselves? Do not be afraid. How can we be strong? How can we take heart and learn from other heroes of faith who have found out how not to be crippled when they feel afraid? Thank you very much for your attention.